Good afternoon and welcome to the second plenary session, which is a big topic. We're going to look at changing social dynamics, both in the Middle East, with the perspective from the Middle East, and also looking at changing social dynamics closer to home. We have two speakers with different perspectives. The Middle East, with Gary Murawai, who's now from the Bahrain Institute of Banking and Finance, but with a very interesting background, which I'll go into in a moment, and Richard Dennis, who's since last year been Executive Director of the Australia Institute. Richard followed Clive Hamilton in that role. Gary, prior to joining the Bahrain Institute of Banking and Finance, he served as Chief Executive Officer of the Institute of Chartered Accountants of New Zealand and would come back and forth to Australia quite regularly in that role. It represents nearly 30,000 members in New Zealand and beyond. He also served as the head of the School of Business at the Auckland University of Technology and was part of the business faculty there for 8 or 10 years, teaching strategy and IT-associated subjects. He took on this role in the Middle East at the Bahrain Institute of Banking and Finance after being headhunted from the UK a couple of years ago. So part of his talk will be about living and working in the Middle East. As part of his role, he's looking very much to the Central Bank and other organisations, both for training and education in their role in the banking and finance sector. He still continues some directorships in New Zealand and has plenty of time to get together with actuaries in his role as the director of the Earthquake Commission in New Zealand. And he's also chair of the very successful Maori Television, so that takes him to New Zealand every couple of months. And now with the web available, he's able to keep an eye on Maori Television whilst living in Bahrain. This is being webcast also, as was our first session, our plenary session this morning. So it's a pleasure now to introduce Gary Murawai.
Hopefully this is working. Bismillah al-Rahman al-Rahim, Assalamu alaikum, and greetings from the Middle East. I'm just going to walk around mainly because I'm suffering a little bit of jet lag, so it's easier just to keep on the move. And I'm really impressed. I've been to a number of conferences, and you can guarantee in the afternoon things dwindle. It's amazing the number of people here. So thank you for making the time. I thought I'd start off by asking if anybody remembers seeing that picture from the Uncle Sam picture with the finger pointing out saying, "Your country needs you." Does that ring any bells? Well, that's what it is with actuaries in the Middle East. The Middle East needs you. And I'm not exaggerating. I've been around a number of the different insurance banks and other parts of the financial sector. And in the last couple of months, people have been saying, "Here's a card, find me one. Here's another card, find me another two." And so there's a lot of opportunities in the Middle East. And apologies for the employers here if it sounds like you might be losing employees. But at the end of the presentation today, I'll just give a few thoughts on how I find the Middle East, because again, it was not an area that I'd worked in at all previously. I'm having a great time, and I think it's a worthwhile time as well. I just thought that was an interesting quote that comes from everybody in here will obviously know Das Kapital from 1867. I won't read it out, but it probably reads very well right up till the last sentence, the last two lines, but it's interesting if you look back in history that long ago and now look at what's happening these days, maybe there are some lessons to be learnt, perhaps not with regard to communism, but in other things. Before I start, I just thought I'd ask a couple of questions. One, and just if you think about it, and well, I'll come back to it later, if I say Middle East to you, what do you think? What's the first thing that comes to your mind? If I say city in the Middle East, what do you think? And here's the hard question. I'm going to mainly be talking about the GCC today with regard to the Middle East, mainly because that's where you can collect data that actually makes sense and is a bit more transparent in that collection. While we're watching two very quick 1 minute videos, can you write down the members of the GCC? Just to give you a clue, there's 6 members of the GCC. There's a reason why I'm asking. So if you could just take the time to write those down if you know. If you don't know, you will shortly. Just a quick overview of what I'm talking about today. really what's happening in the GCC Middle East financial system. I'd really like to give views on the wider financial crisis, but I'm going to stick to the Middle East. Next, just looking at it in terms of what's happening with regard to insurance, and again, the linkages back to actuaries. Thirdly, very quick look at risk management. That was covered really well this morning, so I really won't spend much time at all there. And finally, just it says differences and similarities with Australia and New Zealand. It's really just an expat's view of what it's like to live in the Middle East, good, bad or otherwise. Mostly good. You probably don't need the sound to see what is happening on the screen. It's about another 5 seconds, I think. Well, just a quick show of hands. When I said what comes to mind with the Middle East, who thought that type of situation? So half the people here. We'll just quickly go on to the next one. And apologies, you can actually get the idea without the sound. This one I can talk about if there's no sound. It's the new world development in Dubai. And it just gives what I'm really doing here is giving you a contrast between the two different views that people may have of the Middle East. And you look at some of the amazing buildings and development that's happening. This one is, as many of you already know, they've replicated a map of the world in terms of man-made islands, and you can now buy, well, if you had the money, you could buy Ireland. I think David Beckham bought Ireland, and other countries or parts thereof. That's what it'll look like. It has started, obviously got a bit further than that. Doesn't quite have the same impact, does it, without sound? I'm not a very good singer, so I won't try that either. 5 seconds. When I asked you to think of a city in the Middle East, who thought Dubai? Almost probably 80%, if not more. Well, that was interesting. let's go on. I'm going to come back to both those points at the end, but let's just move on from there. I asked the question, GCC, did you know the 6 members of the GCC? I'll just put them up now. Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and UAE. Anybody get all 6 of them? Okay. There's yes. Less than 3 of you put your hands up, but there's a book of Bahrain pictures that I thought you might find interesting. What is the GCC? That's the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is a grouping of probably the most oil-rich countries, well, most of them, working together. One of their goals is to move to a common currency, working together on infrastructure, on developments. That's a very brief overview of what the GCC is for those that may want to know. I really put up Dubai because Dubai's been in the news lately for all the wrong reasons. I thought I'd start with that. They talk about the Dubai being bailed out by Abu Dhabi after the property bust. I travel there quite often and noticeably less traffic on the road, noticeably less construction happening, a lot of sites that have just stopped. There's been up to a 60% decrease in value of properties that have been sold. The sale price of properties. That's led to quite a few issues in the region. And I really wanted to highlight the fact that Dubai is not the Middle East. You hear all about the good and the bad, and there's been amazing things happening in Dubai. You also hear about the crash. That's the extreme. Foreigners getting laid off from the New York Times. Over half of the construction properties projects are on hold, and that's correct as well. At the end of last year when I went there, one day there was 5 kilometres of lorries back-to-back waiting to get into construction sites. 5 kilometres. Now there's no queues at all. And the expectation is that 200,000 workers will be sent home, and that's already happening. Some figures that I've been given lately is that there's been 31,000 cars abandoned in Dubai. Every day there's up to over 100 cars left at the airport with the keys in the ignition and a note saying, sorry, I'm not coming back. Why is that the case? If you default on payments, be it cars, property, you go to jail. Expats think that a one-way ticket's cheaper than going to jail. So that's an extreme, and it probably wouldn't happen, but that is the law. You have to pay your debts. A lot of expats have also been caught with purchasing multiple properties, 10 at a time, 1% down, selling them before they even become before they're even built. For instance, where I live now, the price it sold for before it was completed was double the price that it was signed for 9 months previously. So that's gone from, in New Zealand dollars, $500,000 to $1 million in 9 months. So it's been amazing, the growth in the whole area. Really, the starting point of what I wanted to talk about with regard to the GCC is that it isn't immune. As we heard, everything's interconnected. Definitely everything's interconnected, and the links with the UK and the US are very strong. That said, it's very resilient, and it's quite simple as to why that's the case. People were concerned about the fact that the price of oil has dropped from a high of 150-odd dollars a barrel down to around the $40 a barrel mark, and there's been a huge outflow of funds because people are worried that if it's going to drop that much, what's going to happen to the economy? What people need to think about is the fact that in the good times, unlike some countries that kept spending and spending, the GCC in particular kept saving and saving and putting money into infrastructure. So that's where the resilience comes from. They are very well positioned to ride out what's happening, but they're not immune. We have seen and we'll continue to see things go wrong. But that said, I'm going to show a few graphs, et cetera, that actually show what's behind the resilience there. Just to give you a starting point, here's some of the write-downs caused by the subprime. And if you look at some of those, $272 million in Abu Dhabi, GIC, $246 million with another $200 million coming, GIB, nearly $1 billion write-down, Arab ABC, $1.2 billion, Gulf Bank Kuwait, $740 million. Even with that happening, their capital adequacies are way, way above the expected. So you're looking at internationally the 8% mark. They're still in the around the 20 mark. So they're very resilient, able to actually ride this out. Look at some of the global write-downs, and these aren't right anymore because it changes by the day. So when it was written, you're looking at the billions, not the millions in those three that I just used as an example. But there are risks, as there are in any country at the moment. As I said, they aren't immune. And I've briefly talked about the property sector, 20 to 60% losses in values, and that's not just in Dubai, that's across the region. It's more apparent in Dubai, even where I live. It's not so much that they've dropped, it's just that sales have dried up, and a lot of the developments are either being put on hold or being drawn out further. Cost and access to funds, huge increase in accessing funds by corporates. So the spread from 100 to 800 points. If you can get funding, liquidity is just, there's just no funds out there in the market at the moment. That's slowly changing, and the margins have actually tightened over the last 2 to 4 weeks, but it still is a problem. As I touched on before, oil revenues forecast to contract by $300 billion this year due to lower oil prices and production. Even at $40 a barrel, when you look at some of the major producers, their cost of production is around $25 a barrel. So they're not doing as well as they were, but they're not hurting as much as a lot of people have expected they would be. That said, there are some smaller nations that aren't as efficient, that their cost is still around the $70 a barrel market, and they're continuing to produce. I don't know for how long. Banking sector profitability, if they're not lending and people are hanging on to their money, it's all coming under strain and stress, like everywhere else in the world. But again, as we go through some of the background, you'll see that it's not as serious as other places. Equity markets, 57, probably a bit more than that now. And again, that's about equivalent to most other places in the world. And that's coming down from the January peak. Foreigners, you look at a lot of the money that's been flowing out of the Middle East and you think, gee, there must be problems there. They're taking all their money out. A lot of them had to repatriate their money. They didn't have choices. You've seen what's happened in the other parts of the market. They had to take their money and take it home. And really what they're doing is taking a wait-and-see approach. They're going to wait and see if the major sovereign wealth funds actually push money into the market. And if they do, and oil prices start to either stabilise or raise slightly, you'll see that money slowly starting to flow back when it can. And as I said, all that said, the starting position is strong. So central banks have still got large foreign reserves. Banks are well capitalised. If you're looking at the international 8%, you're looking at 12 to 26%, depending upon which state in the GCC. I think Saudi would be the lowest, around the 12% mark, then they go up from there. So again, at a global level, it's pretty healthy. I say limited exposure to toxic acids. You saw the assets, you saw my slide before that actually showed that, yes, there have been some substantial losses and there will still be some that are going to come through. And it has impacted on some people's job security. And the first people that do go are expats because they're paid more. That's life. But again, if you look at what's happened over the last little while, you've actually seen a lot of these countries putting money into graduate programs. So they're actually already looking to the future. They've realised there's a problem. They also realise they can't stop the flow of talent coming into the system. For instance, where I live, the government is funding 100 new graduates into the banking sector now, where they put them through a fully funded program to take them from university through to being employed by banks. And the banks are putting their hands up and saying, we'll have one or we'll have two. In some cases, you've got banks taking 10, 12 at a time. So it's still fairly healthy, even though there has been exposure to those toxic acids assets. I also should touch on there that I've got one slide that talks about Islamic finance, which again is one of the reasons why there hasn't been as much exposure, because under Islamic finance and Sharia law, they couldn't be exposed to that. Governments are in a strong financial position. If you look at the gross public sector debt as a percentage of GDP, I've really just listed the six plus. I thought it would be interesting to show the US, which is 90, Japan, 170, UK, 60, and Australia looks pretty healthy. And I realise that you could take other measures and look at the net positions as well, but this is information that I could get that actually showed the comparisons, which I thought were worth looking at. Gross external debt as a percentage of GDP. Again, pretty healthy. I suppose the one that I'd just point out there is Qatar, and it looks quite high. Qatar put a huge amount into infrastructure and productivity type projects, so such as LPG, trains, etc. So even that looks high, they've done it for a specific purpose to sort of ready their whole economy to succeed into the future. Am I in the way? No? Good. Australia, 100%. UK, 400. US, close to the 100% as well. I'm not going to comment too much on that. I think I'll just leave it to you to work through what that means. It's, it doesn't all look healthy, though, does it? Current account positions as a percentage of GDP. Again, that is fairly self-explanatory. Australia and New Zealand don't look too bad when you look at it that in the short term, but again, the whole of the GCC is in a very strong position. And then you look at the large sovereign wealth funds in the area, and they have a significant ability to provide fiscal support. As I say they have the ability, I'm not saying they are at the moment. The market in a lot of cases is waiting to see what they're going to do. And if you look back prior to 9/11, all of their money was being channeled through the US for lots of reasons which are pretty obvious. Their money wasn't perhaps wanted at that time, so they looked elsewhere and they actually went to other emerging markets. You might have seen that both the English, the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, did a tour around the Middle East GCC, trying to encourage these sovereign wealth funds to put their money back into the UK, and the same with the US. So if we look at just some of the amounts involved, Kuwait, $213 billion. These are in billions, not millions. Qatar, $60 billion. And down the side, I've put their GDP as well. Saudi, $330 billion. Abu Dhabi, which is very cash-rich, around $875 billion. And Dubai, $82 billion. So that sort of gives you a feel for what impact they can have if they want to put their money back into the region, as opposed to pushing it to different parts of the world. So economic slowdown, not recession. If we just look at that very quickly, is this right, the one on the right-hand end? I got this last week showing that Australia was expecting 0.5% growth. Then I looked up the Westpac website and it said negative 0.7%. Is it going to be, just a show of hands if it's going to be positive in terms of what you've heard? Nobody. Right, one person up there, I think you work for the government. GCC, again, it's over 3.5%, but again, the figures have been changing. These are just estimates, and it looks like it could be slightly lower than that, but it is still positive as of yesterday. Government-funded infrastructure projects, and I think this is another guide to see why things aren't as gloomy as you might well think. If you look at the list there, you've got Bahrain with infrastructure projects of $40 billion, Kuwait $267 billion, $92 billion, $15 billion, $492 billion, $904 billion, and a huge total. And if you look at it as a percentage of GDP, you can see that these countries are putting money into infrastructure. They are setting themselves up for the future. They've been very careful on what they used their money for in the past. They didn't. For instance, they aren't the world's policemen. They have put money aside, and they're making it pay. I just said I'd touch on Islamic finance or Islamic banking as well. And I'll keep it very, very brief, and I'll add to it an ad that my institute won the world's best Islamic finance training organisation, so if you'd like to know more, we're happy to come and talk about it. The main thing here is it is just another system. It's got one extra step, which has got Sharia scholars, which says it might be a good business idea, but you have to get it checked out with the Sharia scholars, the religious scholars, to make sure that it's able to be done under Islamic law. And what does that mean? The main two that I want to touch on is interest. You don't get interest. You don't charge interest. If an organisation charges interest, that has to be donated. People say, well, how does it work? It's a profit share and a loss share. So I put money into a fund for a specific purpose with defined assets. If it succeeds, I get the payout based on that. If it doesn't, I lose on it. That said, they've also used a mechanism for smoothing, which I'm not quite sure exactly how it works if you take it literally, but it means that and for the end result, there has been very little difference between conventional finance and Islamic finance. How you get there differs. There are some things that can't be done within Islamic finance, and that's one of the reasons why they haven't got caught with toxic assets. The major risk is that a lot of Islamic banks are involved in property. So there is a possibility that there will be a sort of shakeout of some of those issues. Prohibition on ambiguity and uncertainty. So you have to have a specific asset. It can't be something that can't be seen and transferred ownership immediately. It has to be defined and there has to be no doubt about who owns it. My thoughts, I just thought I'd add a couple of things in here because Islamic finance hasn't been going that long. You've got the fact that it's It was really developed in the 1970s approximately as a system, and it was developed by the West to try and attract money from cash or high net worth individuals who would not put their money into conventional banking or conventional finance systems. From there it evolved into two main areas, one being the Middle East, one being Malaysia. My thoughts are that it's, because it is very young, I couldn't definitely say that it would never be caught by toxic assets, because human beings are quite creative in terms of how they structure things to meet particular rules, and it's one of the reasons I'm very strong on more regulation isn't always a good idea, because it's the principle-based approach that's more important. So it's been doing well. It's been growing at 20% per annum, the whole market. It hasn't been affected the way others have, but it is very new. So there are still some things that have to be worked through. I'm not going to cover much on risk management. I've got a couple of slides, but I'll really just zip over them. I suppose in the main, what I see is that people have relied too much on the quantitative side of risk without necessarily understanding what sits behind them. And if you look at regulation, it's the job of a regulator also to understand these things. And it's, I know it's difficult and that's a challenge, but that has to happen. Definitely a role for actuaries to understand behind those models, understand about extreme event and tail risk, not just follow blindly a model that's been put forward by interested parties. So a lack of rigour, and I think that's something that's been highlighted lately, and something especially in the Middle East that they've identified as an area that they want better education, better understanding. The first point was they're bringing in lots of expats that are new risk officers and risk managers and directors. They're also very interested in providing the qualifications in the area of risk. Obviously, you've got FRM and PRM. One of the things I was talking to a few people today was that the actuary profession is needed in the Middle East, and it's needed badly. There's huge opportunities. One is to bring people in, the other is to grow people within that system. So hopefully there'll be linkages between the best bodies which are represented here and the Middle East to make these things happen. As I mentioned, an over-reliance on quantitative modelling. I actually think you're going to see this, and I was talking to your president today that you need more actuaries on boards. I'm on one board only that's got an actuary on, and the value he adds is huge. And I think you're going to see more and more of it. And if I was an actuary right now, I'd be doing IOD courses, Institute of Director courses, to ready myself for that, because I think it's not far away that boards need to go past. I know that I come from an accounting background, probably need slightly less accountants. No, you need the same accountants, but more actuaries, to be fair. I think that's self-explanatory. I won't go into that in terms of time. Let's just quickly look at the insurance area. And I thought I'd show a couple of slides and just show some of the opportunities in particular for actuaries. So in the Middle East and North Africa area, you've got 20% only in life, 80% non-life, and that's compared with the worldwide average of 60% and 40%. Why so low in life? Does anybody have an idea of why it's so low? Under Islamic law, it's not in you can't insure life in the conventional sense. With Takaful Insurance, they're looking at models that you can actually have a grouping that actually helps that be achieved. The same result, but in a different way. Again, that'll increase the need for people to actually understand the process of how you calculate cover, etc. And that's going to be a growth area as I see it in the future. The non-life in the Middle East, the three M's, motor, marine and medical. That's going to, if you look at the next slide, not very much money's been put into this area. And again, that's changing. People are starting to understand the need to have insurance cover. The people I've talked to about how they calculate premiums and different bits of businesses, they don't do it necessarily the right way. They're looking at what competitors do. They don't necessarily understand the underlying risk. That's changing. And that's, again, coming back to the need for actuaries. Now, I've got this slide from Leslie Traverso down here. And it was in one of your publications. And that just down the right-hand side says, right now, how many actuaries are required if nothing else changed? That's just a starting point. That's what's needed immediately. Tomorrow would be good, or after the weekend, that'll be fine too. Sooner the better. But the whole area is growing. It's got a good base. It's going to need more rigour in all the different systems. I see huge potential. Just thought I'd touch on Te Kawhi insurance, because it's something that potentially not many people know about yet. And it's really just a way of getting a result by structuring it differently. And I know there's experts here, because at least one person's emailed me, so if I get anything wrong, just correct me in the question and answer and I'll nod. Charitable donations. So the example is that if you're in the Middle East, if you're in, say, a village, and the average cost of a house is 100,000, and you've got 1,000 people, charitable donation would be put in by each one of those if the known risk was that maybe one house a year burns down. And that's how Te Kawhi works. So it's a small grouping together, taking out an administrative cost for the insurance company or a share of the premiums, which is allowed. And then if there is no event that year, it has to be redistributed back. So that's the principle. So it's not just spreading it out amongst whomever and it's potluck. It's a defined grouping for a defined period. So that's a very brief look at what it is. Is anybody interested in what the lifestyle of living in the Middle East is? Good, all right. Climate. These are just a random number of things that I thought. I've asked other expats, what do you think you should talk about? What should I talk about with a group that may not know a lot about the Middle East and wants to know more? The climate, when I left 2 days ago, it's about 27 degrees during the day, 24 overnight. And some countries increased by maybe 2 to 3 degrees on that. So it's within that range of, at the moment, of 20 to 29, 30. If I look across the whole year at where I live, August, everybody has August off because that's when it hits around 50 degrees. And the half of July and the half of September is pretty hot too, so in the mid-40s. A dry heat, so it doesn't actually feel as hot as what it does here. And you don't get sunburnt the way you do in Australia and New Zealand. That said, everybody lives in air-conditioned offices, and you go from your car to the office, and it really doesn't make any difference. I live on a man-made island, so every day I've got a kayak and a bike, and it's every day. It was nice to come here and actually get rain, because it doesn't rain. What rains? Last year it rained for a quarter of an hour where I am. So that varies. Is it? What about the greenery? If it only rains that much, where I live again, it's desalination is used, and one plant produces 90 million litres a day from the seawater, 90 million litres a day. So all the water comes from that, but nobody drinks it. That's for watering things and cleaning your car, but you drink bottled water. So in terms of greenery, yes, there is greenery, and it's because of the usage of trucks to keep everything green. There's a lot of dust too. That's why you wash your car a lot too. I put family friendly, amazingly friendly part of the world. Amazingly friendly, very family orientated. Some of you might say too family orientated for what you'd like, because over there your children don't leave living with their parents till they get married. So you can meet families with a 40-year-old and a 38-year-old son or daughter that's still at home, and maybe that's a bit much for most people, but that's the approach. In terms of friendliness, you can't fault it. And I'm talking about where I am in Bahrain. Obviously, I'll talk about some of the other areas that have different lifestyles. Very good education systems for expats. If an expat, for instance, if somebody here went to work in the Middle East, you'd get a package that wouldn't be less than what you get here, but you don't pay any tax. So automatically you're 40% better off as a starting salary. Education's included in your package. So, for instance, I employed a New Zealander 2 months ago. They brought their three children. They're all in schools. He said they're the best schools I've ever been to. And it's all paid as part of the package. I put this up here because one thing I do see is expats, I suppose, acting differently than what they would at home. And to be fair, I don't see Australians and New Zealanders doing this, but I do see some others taking on what I'd call airs and graces that they shouldn't take on. And I think that taking the time to learn about the culture is amazingly important, and it's such a rich culture that it's worth finding out about and seeing how things work. It's nothing like I expected it to be. As I said, amazingly friendly. What did I put up there? Including alcohol. Quick example, I took my management team when I first got there out to dinner, and I said, right, who likes red wine and who likes white wine? And a couple of them, or half of them, said, oh, I'll have a drink of red, thanks. So I bought a bottle, and at the halfway through I realised that it was still half a bottle left, which in Australia and New Zealand was just unbelievable. Nobody drank it. Nobody drank it. They left it on the table. They were being polite. I learnt quickly that it's not appropriate. When you're in an expat situation, fine, but really living with the culture is really important, and I wouldn't do that again. Driving. They drive on the other. Well, we drive on the other side of the road, and let me say that compared with here, Australian and New Zealand drivers are amazingly good. Cost of living, I don't find any difference to New Zealand, and that's converting it back. So people say it must be more expensive. I can buy Australia and New Zealand beef and lamb cheaper there than I can here, for instance.
Should be an inquiry.
Should be. Should be. When I've left. Yes. Remuneration and taxes, I'm going to finish very quickly. You don't pay tax. I'll just put these up. I thought you might be interested in petrol, 37 cents a litre. Law and ownership, just be aware that the laws are developing, so ownership of property is slightly less sure than what you'd be used to. I'm going to stop there, and thank you for listening. Thank you.